kind of a show do we have for you today on the Young Turks? Is it a shao show? No. It's a massive show. Giant news just came out right before we went on air. I'm going to tell you about it in a second. Down goes, all right, you'll see in a second. Hold on now. Election night tonight, the official kickoff of the 2018 elections. We had a special election in Arizona last week, but the 2018 cycle begins today. By the way, the polls close in a couple of hours in Texas. So if you're still in Texas, go vote in the primaries. Vote. If you want to know how to vote in any state that you're in, go to tytnetwork.com/register. So John and I will be giving you election night coverage tonight, and we are going to be talking to a lot of the candidates. Beto O'Rourke is in a race. He is likely to go up against Ted Cruz eventually. That's really interesting. You got 7 Justice Democrats up tonight. So decision night already in March here in America. Okay, and then later in the program, the Russians going after a former spy. Yes, that would appear to be the Russian government. A Russian journalist stabbed in the throat. How does she respond to that? And then there's so many amazing, wonderful stories. There's unfortunately stories of corruption, but stories of redemption as well. That's why we call it the Young Turks, okay? So without further ado, let's get going. Okay. Now, Donald Trump just put out a tweet a little while ago, of course, early in the morning, saying that he's got everything under control in the White House. Later in the day, turned out not the case. But first, let's read the tweet. It's super fun. He says, the new fake news narrative is that there is chaos, capitalized. If I was trying to say there isn't chaos, I wouldn't have capitalized chaos. But anyway, that there's chaos in the White House. Wrong. People always come and go, and I want strong dialogue before making a final decision. I still have some people that I want to change, always seeking perfection. There's no chaos, only great energy. Who puts out a statement like that? If a reality show host puts out a statement like that, you wonder if they should pull them off air. I mean, look, I get it. You want drama for ratings, but that's a little too mental, right? But he's no longer a reality show host. He's the president of the United States. Could you imagine if Obama sent out a tweet? I mean, they'd go have doctors go check in on him. There's no chaos, only great energy. Is that what we're calling it now, energy? Okay, well, Jeb Bush has got to be smiling today, thinking for the first time being low energy turns out to be a good thing. Okay, so he puts out that tweet, and it's fun and games. I was going to tell you about the tweet anyway because it's funny. Then it turns out chaos ensues. Are you ready?
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Yeah. Down goes Gary Cohn. Down goes Cohn. So now, look, it's not Donald Trump, don't get too excited. But Gary Cohn, top economic advisor to the president, one of the most important people in the White House. He was the president and COO of Goldman Sachs. Donald Trump during the campaign ran against the global elites and the globalists, as he would call them. He even showed the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein, in those ads. Blankfein and Cohn worked together for a long amount of time. So he goes into the Trump White House anyway, and now he is out. So why? That's a super important question. In the official reports, they say, well, he disagreed with the steel and aluminum tariffs, and he lost that fight. It ain't about no aluminum tariffs. Okay, there's two reasons why Gary Cohn's leaving. One is mission accomplished. What do I mean, mission accomplished? I mean, this White House is an absolute disaster and an absolute disarray. So why is it mission accomplished? All Gary Cohn wanted was the giant tax cuts. The tax cuts for the banks, like Goldman Sachs. Tax cuts for the rich, like Gary Cohn and everyone he knows. And for all the corporations. We're done here, man. I told you guys. I said the minute that they get those tax cuts, the establishment's done with Donald Trump. That's the main thing he's gonna get, and the rest is just playing out the string. And Cohn is in the heart of the establishment. So that's reason number one. He already got what he wanted. Aluminum tariffs. Aluminum tariffs. We're talking about that. Now, look, Gary Cohn is not in favor of that, and he thinks it's bad for the economy overall. He's not in favor of trade wars. I understand that. But that is a minor issue in the landscape of the madness of the Donald Trump White House. So the second major issue is anyone with two bits of sense has got to get the hell out of there. It's about to implode. Look, the rest of the media, for all that they attack Donald Trump, they're still not getting it. The standard politicians, they're not getting it. Certainly the rest of the country doesn't understand how close we are. I keep telling you guys, we're not that far away from the end. He's going to be gone soon. In the last 7 days or so, he lost Hope Hicks, his communications director. He lost Gary Cohn, his top economic advisor. Now he's lost so many people, I'm losing track. Who's the third major person that left? Who just pulled the chute? We just had a giant person leave. Anyway, that's how insane it is. People are dropping out like nuts. If two of those people had left in like a year in the Obama administration, people are like, what is this? It's madness. I'm now driving myself crazy. Anybody remember who left the White House within the last week? Hope Hicks, I know, and Gary Cohn left today. Jesus, Lord mercy! Everybody on Twitter screaming it at me, but I can't. I don't have Twitter in front of me. Okay, so anyways, you think Gary Cohn wants to get stuck holding the bag when they come for Donald Trump? He wants plausible deniability. He wants to say, yeah, I'm gone, man. Me, the Russian investigation, no. They got Trump after I left. I didn't have anything to do with that, man. I didn't have anything to do with that. All these people aren't leaving because things are going well. No, they're about to get him. Again, I know a lot of people say, oh, you don't know that. You know, that's just speculation, man. Okay, let's see what happens. But this is devolving very, very quickly. All these people like Rick Gates have turned evidence on not just Manafort, but Donald Trump. They're closing in. Look at the panic of Sam Nunberg on television yesterday. And Gary Cohn might be a lot of things, but he ain't dumb. So he's thinking, I got our tax cuts and I don't need any of this hot mess. So I'm gone. And that is the sensible move. And soon there'll be one more person leaving from the White House. Hear me now, quote me later. Okay, all right, we move forward. Now, more Trump madness. Let's get going. Okay, I got too many stories for you guys. So, this is an amusing story because someone thought that Donald Trump wasn't lying to them. In this case, it happens to be the Australian government. A while ago, he made a promise to them, and now come to find out that he didn't mean it. No, really. But they are genuinely surprised, which amuses me. HuffPost reporting here, Australian media is accusing President Donald Trump of reneging on a promise he reportedly made to Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull last year. They're accusing him of that because it's true. So let's give you the details. Trump, quote, emphatically promised Turnbull that Australian steel and aluminum would be exempt from any steel and aluminum tariffs imposed by the US, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation reported. The agreement, which was reportedly witnessed by several US and Australian officials, occurred during the G20 meeting in Germany last July. Look, I don't know how many times I gotta say this. Trump doesn't mean anything he says. So there's several reasons for this. One, he's a pathological liar. So he'll tell you one thing in 1 minute, forget a year later, a minute later, he'll tell you the opposite. Just yesterday, I did a story on the show about how he contradicted himself within the same tweet. Okay. Second of all, he doesn't have any philosophy or principles. So, what is his governing philosophy on aluminum tariffs? He doesn't have one. So, when he promised them that he would exempt Australia, what was that based on? Was it based on a principle of we will exempt allies because we think it's better for the economy or better for foreign policy? And among the allies will be Australia, the UK, etc. No, he didn't put any thought into it. You know why? Because he's dumb. He didn't think if I give Australia an exemption, I might have to give New Zealand one. Is that going to be based on regions or going to be based on allies? How am I going to make those decisions? No, Turnbull probably gave him a compliment, said, hey, Mr. President, you have awfully large hands. And he was like, okay, that's it. You're exempt from the tariffs. That's right. And a year later, you think he's going to listen to that? No, somebody else is going to come in the room and tell him he has large hands. He's going to be like, Australia's out. That's it. And right now, what's the reality? They're out. Nobody's getting an exemption. Companies might get exemptions, which would lead to terrible corruption as they try to convince the government to give them exemptions one by one in a system of institutionalized crony capitalism. But there are no exemptions countrywide. Trump, as always, didn't mean it, was lying to you, didn't even know what the hell he was saying. So Tom McElroy says on Twitter here, opposition leader Bill Shorten says it appears Donald Trump has dudded Australia, which is an awesome term, on failing to keep his promise to Malcolm Turnbull to accept Australian steel exports from planned tariffs, to exempt Australian steel exports from planned tariffs in the US. Yes, in fact, Australia, you have been dudded, as have all of us. Steve Chobo, the Australian trade minister, says, I'm not going to provide a commentary on the Trump administration's trustworthiness. I do declare that one stung. Is Donald Trump and his administration trustworthy? Of course not. Don't be preposterous. And I like how they got their feelings hurt. You should have known that from day one. Okay, now we're moving forward. One more Trump story about broken promises. Okay. Curious story comes out today. Let me quote here from Nick Visser and Chris D'Angelo at HuffPost. The US Fish and Wildlife Service has quietly begun allowing more trophy hunting of African elephants, despite President Donald Trump's pledge last year to uphold a ban on importing parts of animals killed by big game hunters. Yeah, when I read that headline, I thought, wait, didn't Trump say the opposite? And wasn't he fairly emphatic? In fact, he was. Let's go to that tweet from earlier. Trump said, big game trophy decision will be announced next week, and that was back in November of 2017, but will be very hard pressed to change my mind that this horror show in any way helps conservation of elephants or any other animal. Wow, those are strong words indeed. Well, he's definitely not going to change his mind, right? Did he change his mind? Of course, because he has no mind to change. So somebody came in and was like, should we just ignore the idiot in the White House and just do what we want to do anyway? Obama had banned this form of trophy hunting. Trump's administration wanted to reopen it back up. Trump finds out how they butcher the animals, and you know, for a rare moment of morality, he goes, well, that's a horror show, I don't want that. And then they go, just wait him out, he's a moron, he'll lose focus and we'll just do it anyway. And that's what they're doing right now. Speaking of horror show, can I just show you what that horror show looks like? Whew. That, I believe, is an elephant hunt by Donald Trump Jr. You cut that part off and then with a knife, and then you thought that was a cool thing to take a picture and show to your friends. And oh, congratulations on killing these species. To be fair, I'm pretty sure that those animals also had rifles, right? No, you just murdered them. Okay, wow, you must be so brave. Anyway, that's the horror show that Donald Trump is talking about. And for the first time, he is right about his sons. Now, here is senior attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity, Tanya Sanareb. A good person trying to make sense of this. She says, what the agency just did with this memo is completely contrary to everything Trump has been saying. That's right, Tanya. Yeah, it is. Because Donald Trump can't be trusted for a second. He doesn't mean anything he says. He's a pathological liar. How many times do I have to go over this? You got to stop getting surprised. Nothing ever stays with Donald Trump. He will change every opinion he has to whatever is politically expedient the next second. All right, last quote for you guys. The decision was first revealed publicly by Safari Club International, and this goes to why in the world they're even changing this position. A trophy hunting advocacy group with close ties to the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. That's the beginning of the answer. The group, along with the National Rifle Association sued to block the 2014 ban on elephant trophies from Zimbabwe. Because I was wondering, I'm like, look, who's bothering to undo Donald Trump's decision on this? There isn't a lot of money involved. Okay, Ryan Zinke is a guy who really wants to make sure that this continues. He's probably got a couple of millionaire buddies who donated to him, etc. But it's not enough to move the needle on this, especially when Donald Trump was so adamant so publicly. Ah, the NRA, there you go. Now it turns out the NRA wants it, and if the NRA wants something, they'll get it. Trump administration keeps talking about, oh, we're going to keep the NRA in check. You can't keep yourself in check. So for the millionth time in a row, another Donald Trump promise broken. All right, we're going to come right back. And when we do, we got news on Republicans. We got news on Democrats. We got news on Americans. We got news on Russians. Bloop, 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 bloop. We'll be right back. Yeah, it only took me 28 minutes, but I finally remembered. McMaster, his national security advisor, is apparently also leaving. Okay, back on the Young Turks, obviously. I'm going to read two tweets and then we're moving. Mrs. Data says, rats are impressed at how fast these enabling fools are jumping off this sinking ship. And Carrie G says, Jesus tap dancing Christ, is this administration determined to kill everything? Children, animals, national parks, oceans, working families, super. Yes, it is quite bad. How fast Gary Cohn left is awesome. It's like, should I stay for the indictment of the president? Should I stay for when the FBI comes in and gets all of our computers? No, I think I'm going to go back to Wall Street. All right, let's go over here. He's gone, guys. You guys don't get it. He's gone. They already did the move, the thing in Kill Bill. His heart explodes later politically. Okay, anyway. All right, we're moving. Russians, here we go. Oh, no, I said Russians. Okay, here we go. We've got another former Russian spy in a world of trouble, poisoned. Gee, I wonder who did it. And it happened in the United Kingdom. So let me tell you the story. The mystery surrounding former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter, who remain in critical condition at a hospital in the United Kingdom after being exposed to an unknown substance, escalated Tuesday as Britain's government accused Russia of being responsible. You don't say. Really? I thought perhaps the Nigerians or the Swedes were interested in killing a former Russian spy who turned on the Russians. Was it the Russian government? Of course it was. Anyway, Skripal and his daughter were found on a bench at a mall in Salisbury on Sunday. According to a statement from the police in England's Worcester County, they were both being treated for suspected exposure to an unknown substance. Gee, I wonder if I've seen this movie before. All right, so now we go to a quote from a witness who found them, and this is eerie. Explaining first the spy and then his daughter, he had his palms up to the sky as if he was shrugging and was staring at the building in front of him. I remember looking back at him thinking he would catch my eye, but he was staring dead straight. He was conscious, but it was like he was frozen and he was slightly rocking back and forward. That's a passerby who said that. She continued, the woman was slumped onto his shoulder. So I don't know what kind of poison that is, but it's a bad one, and they're in a world of trouble, and they're in the hospital now. The substance has not yet been identified, nor have police confirmed if any criminal activity took place. I got news for them, it did. Anyway, the police declared the case a major incident, and multiple agencies, including the country's counterterrorism police force, are investigating. And by the way, it's not just those two. One member of the emergency service that dealt with Skripal and his daughter is also in the hospital. So not good news here in that regard. And it turns out that when you poison folks, other people might get it as well. That is why poisoning people in a foreign country is not a great idea. And they tend to get pretty angry about that. That almost looks like Russian interference in another country. But I don't know, is there enough evidence? I can't quite tell. Anyway, Skripal, a former colonel in the Russian military intelligence, was accused of spying for Britain in 2006. and sentenced by Russia to 13 years in prison. He was pardoned in 2010 and released to the US as part of a high profile spy swap and later flown to Britain. So look guys, on the one hand, yes, the West also messes with Russia. I get that, and we have been encroaching into their sphere of influence by expanding NATO, for example. So that's real, and that doesn't often get reported in the national press here in America, or much in the West at all. On the other hand, if you think that the Russian government, led by Vladimir Putin, is a shrinking violet, and I'm not saying that anybody thinks that, but sometimes people act like they think that, and oh golly gee, poor Vlad, he wouldn't know how to interfere in any other country's business. Well, I think you got the wrong guy. So this is now a number of hits that they have done outside the country. I mean, that is previous to Putin doing this apparently over and over. I hadn't really seen that much anywhere, except the bad old days when we used to go assassinate people left and right. So, and of course the Russians did it back then. We had a nice little lull there, where we weren't killing people in other countries. But now apparently we're back to that, let alone interfering in elections, etc. Right? By the way, this is again not the first time. A 2016 inquiry by the British government found Russian agency FSB, which succeeded the KGB, had Litvinenko, another former Russian spy, killed in an operation, I love this, quote, probably approved by Putin. You think? So again, let's not be naive here, guys. If there is an operation sophisticated enough and crazy enough to go kill a former Russian spy in a different country, you think Putin didn't approve that? Let's say that he didn't the first time. An oligarch did it, a Russian mobster did it, someone else did it. You think Vladimir let it happen a second time and he didn't know about it? Please, I mean, look, I hope that no one's that naive, whether they're on the right or the left. It's a preposterous thing to think. So yes, when they do it over and over again, it usually has the blessing of the guy at the top. Do I have to clarify that? Is that really a complicated thought for folks? Anyway, now one last piece here from a different publication, Business Insider, and I didn't know this. And I was set to do this story, and then somebody pointed this out to me before we went on air, and I thought I'd give you a little bit of extra context. Don't get over focused on this, but it is a data point. The ex-Kremlin spy, as Business Insider points out, found unconscious on a bench in Britain, almost certainly has links to Christopher Steele, the man who penned the explosive Russia dossier on US President Donald Trump, experts told Business Insider. Now, look, their ties are unclear. It was he the source for Steele? Unlikely, he's been in Britain for a while. So again, don't over focus on that aspect of the story, but yet another former British spy with obviously a hit on their life, whether successful or not. And the last time that a former Russian spy was poisoned, it took 3 weeks for him to die in the hospital. And as he was dying, he said it was Putin. Well, again, of course. Of course, no one does this at this level unauthorized by the Russian leadership. And there is no other country going around killing Russian spies. These are strange times, so I feel like I have to over-explain the most obvious things in the world. Okay, we're moving forward. Okay, now let's go back to national politics and the Democrats. So there's an incumbent named Dan Lipinski. I'm going to show you his voting record. He voted against the Affordable Care Act. He's anti-choice. He voted to defund Planned Parenthood. He voted for Marriage and Religious Freedom Act, which takes equal rights away from gay Americans. So it's weird. Why am I showing him next to Nancy Pelosi? Is this, you know, bipartisanship? A Republican working with a Democrat? No. He's a Democrat. He's a Democrat in Illinois. Illinois is a blue state. His district, by the way, is not deeply red within the blue state of Illinois. No, he just happens to be incredibly conservative. Well, okay, but I hear from Nancy Pelosi that Nancy Pelosi is really progressive. So I'm sure that she won't care about protecting the establishment, but doing the right thing for progressive policy, right? So I mean, this guy's against abortion rights. He voted to defund Planned Parenthood. You're not going to support him, are you, Representative Pelosi? Well, let's find out. They asked her, here's Natalie Andrews reporting that, do you support Dan Lipinski's reelection? Nancy Pelosi, yes, I do. Well, she's not alone. When you have progressives, you have bipartisanship because both the Republicans and the Democrats will attack them. For example, Laura Moser in Texas, Greg Edwards in Pennsylvania, Bernie Sanders everywhere. And when you have conservatives, you'll have bipartisanship again, both Republicans and Democrats supporting them, like Dan Lipinski. So there is also a super PAC supporting Lipinski, and it's a Republican one. It's called United for Progress Incorporated. Don't get confused by the progress. That's a Republican super PAC backing the Democratic nominee that Nancy Pelosi also enthusiastically supports. Okay, now by the way, look, I get it. Again, these establishment Democrats, their patronizing attitude is so annoying. Well, did you know that she's actually the leader of the Democrats in the House, and hence it's fairly normal for her to support incumbents? Yes, of course we know that. But there are some incumbents that are backed by Republican super PACs that keep voting against you that you might not want to support, that you might want to make an exception for when there's a perfectly good progressive in a progressive district that could have that seat instead. His opponent is Mary Newman. Marie Newman, you should find out more about her. In fact, here, let me give you some links where you could go and get more and involved, whether you volunteer or donate. Marie Newman is a just Democrat. That means she's uncorrupted, does not take corporate PAC money, and that's probably why the Democratic Party is not fully backing her. Anyway, justdemocrats.com/dumpdan if you want to donate, and for volunteering, Marie Newman for Congress. .com/events, okay? Get involved, get involved. By the way, Lipinski thought, it's okay, I got Pelosi, I got the establishment. Then a number of progressive groups actually came out in favor of Marie Newman, and he's like, whoa. Again, by the way, just as Democrats led, other groups begrudgingly followed, but we'll take their help and bless their hearts. So now, what does it look like in the polls? When just Democrats first said they were backing Newman, well, come on, does she really stand a chance? Lipinski's got all this money, he's the incumbent, he's got the name recognition. Here comes Newman! Latest poll out, 43% Dan Lipinski, all of a sudden 41% Marie Newman, and 15% undecided. He ain't gonna win, she's gonna win, get in the fight. His only chance is that he has so much money from his corruption. Lipinski still has a large cash advantage, according to The Hill, over Newman with $1.6 million in the bank. Let me give you those links again for Newman. Because your volunteer hours are worth their weight in gold. So go out there and volunteer if you're in her district. And if you're not, get in the fight, donate whatever you can, $3, $10, $27, whatever you can. Because yes, we're not gonna match the $1.6 million, but we don't need that. We need power and energy. We need some money to be able to hire staff to get the job done. The Illinois primaries are coming up. There is no reason in the world that a Democrat as conservative as Dan Lipinski should be representing a progressive district. Get him out, dump Dan, and go with a real progressive. Okay, I'm not done yet. Let's go to, speaking of corporate Democrats, I got a doozy for you guys. And we broke the story, okay. All right, I have another story for you guys from TYT and Investigates. This is the wonderful group funded by our audience, and they're out there doing what other folks are not, which is investigating where the money is coming from and why the congressmen and the senators are making the decisions that they are. So the rest of the media will report, Heidi Heitkamp, for example, the person that this story is about, the senator from North Dakota, has to vote with the Republicans from time to time. She just has to because of the state that she's in. Now that is very shallow analysis of the situation. So it's our job at the Young Turks to go a little deeper, and in that regard, TYT Investigates goes and gets the facts to help us do that. So let's look at those facts. Alex Koch reporting for us here. This week, the US Senate will consider a bipartisan bill to massively roll back regulations put in place to prevent the risky financial practices that led to the 2008 economic crisis. Now that doesn't seem like a good idea. I wonder why they're doing that. Well, first of all, I want to just dip into reporting by Vox at Matt Iglesias here to give you a little bit of context, and then I'll get back to our report. The bank bill would be a golden opportunity, Matt explains, to exert some influence over the Republicans, especially on the issue of finance. But they haven't done it, the Democrats. The dozen moderates voting for the legislation aren't striking a deal with the GOP to get something done. They're giving away the store. And that's true. They're not saying, hey, we'll trade you banking deregulation, which could destabilize the whole economy, if you give us some progressive priorities. No, they're just saying, oh, we like banking deregulation. Curious. Why do they? Well, let's find out. So Elizabeth Warren calls this act hashtag Bank Lobbyist Act. And she does that because the banks have been furiously lobbying for this bill and this legislation throughout. There's probably good reason for that, because they're going to make money at our expense, take higher risk, which leads to higher return for them, but then potentially craters our economy. So Heidkamp in particular, what could be her motivations? Well, as Koch reports here, one of the bill's chief architects, Senator Heidi Heidkamp, and her husband have nearly $1 million invested in two of the bill's biggest winners, JP Morgan Chase and Berkshire Hathaway, according to a 2016 financial disclosure document reviewed by TYT Investigates. You dig just a little bit and you might find out the real reasons why these politicians vote the way that they do. I encourage you to get all the details. We have the link to the article down below in the description box on YouTube and comment section on Facebook. You'll find out she has $4.5 million, but $1 million is still a huge chunk of that. So she has a lot to gain from supporting the Republicans in deregulating these banks, at least in the short term. Heidkamp's commercial banking industry's number one recipient of campaign donations in the current election cycle, having reported receipts of $157,000 from the bank's employees and political action committees. So not only does she have her own money invested in these banks at a huge sum, she's also the number one recipient of their campaign donations. Gee, I wonder why she's supporting them. I wonder if it's based on principles or how her voters are going to vote. I mean, people say that and they don't question it at all. Really, the good people of North Dakota can't wait to deregulate the banks? That's a top priority for them? Really? Have you ever asked them? I've seen the polling in deeply red states. They don't like the bankers. They don't like them at all. That's why Eric Cantor lost in his race. In a legendary upset, he was a Republican leader, the House Majority Leader, and he lost in a primary because his opponent ran against the banks. There is no data supporting that the people of North Dakota love giant banks, and that's why Heidkamp voted that way. That is not why she votes that way. She does it for the donations and she does it for her personal interest. I know that that seems so uncivil to point out, and that's why the rest of the mainstream media are like, oh, I do declare, shush, shush, shush. Don't talk about the real motivations. Those are the real motivations. Okay, by the way, she's not alone. Her fellow co-sponsors, Senator Joe Donnelly, also a Democrat, and Senator John Tester, also a Democrat, come in second and third respectively on that list of commercial banking industry's campaign donations. It turns out the three Democrats they gave the most amount of money to turned around and voted exactly in the way that they wanted. What a wild coincidence. Again, we have an auction. We don't have a democracy. You got to get all the money out of politics. Look, wolf-pack.com, okay? Wolfpack's looking to get an amendment to end this. And sometimes Republican legislators of the states will ask Wolfpack volunteers or leaders, hey, do you guys also want to get the Democratic money out of politics? Of course we do. Why would we want corrupt Democrats and corrupt Republicans? It doesn't make any sense. We just want to end the corruption. It's so obvious. But I'm sure you saw this all over CNN, right? No, never, never. They never talk about this. Okay, back to our report here. More on the context how this will affect, this legislation will affect Berkshire Hathaway in particular. Now, that's Warren Buffett's company. Warren Buffett sometimes says positive things about Democrats. So Berkshire Hathaway must be awesome, right? And that's why Heidkamp is supporting them, not because of her own personal interests. I mean, they're not going to benefit from deregulation, are they? And maybe bend the rules or so. Well, let's find out. Clayton Homes and Vanderbilt Mortgage, the nation's largest mobile home empire, and its lending operation, both subsidiaries of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, formerly pressured minority borrowers into unfavorable loans with hidden fees and repossessed the homes of those who couldn't pay. Same old games, and that's exactly what Heitkamp and her colleagues are going to let them do again. So now, just to give you further context, they are not alone. The corruption is rampant. So several other co-sponsors of this bill have large investments in financial firms. As of 2016, Senator John Kennedy, he's a Republican of Louisiana, owned up to $50,000. Senator David Perdue, Republican of Georgia, owned up to $100,000 in JP Morgan corporate securities stock. Senator Mark Warner, worth roughly $238 million in 2015, has between $5 million and $25 million invested in JP Morgan's strategic income opportunities. One mutual fund primary sponsor, Senator Mike Crapo, as he calls it, Republican of Idaho, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, and his spouse have up to $80,000 invested in JP Morgan mutual funds. So they all get rich, and then when the economy crashes, don't worry, you're going to find that those same centrist Democrats and Republicans are all going to vote for another bailout of the banks that they partly own. This corruption is gross, and it's not anywhere near democracy. All right, speaking of democracy, let me go to Italy for you guys. Now, I've been telling you guys for a long time that there is a massive anti-establishment mood all over the world. I said that Jeremy Corbyn would close a gigantic lead that his opponent had in the UK. Folks thought that didn't make any sense because the UK just voted for Brexit. That means they're going right wing. No, people are not going right wing. They're not going left wing. They're just saying no more to the establishment. We can't take it anymore. And it drives me crazy when folks can't figure out the clear direction that the voters are sending, again, all across the world. They've done it again now in Italy. At least this time, a lot of the press is beginning to pick up on it. I'm like, huh. But this one is so obvious, so let me give it to you. We go to Express first over in the UK. Over 50% of Italians voted for avowedly Eurosceptic parties in an expression of rage against the pro-European establishment. Told you, okay? One more from them. Eurosceptic and anti-establishment party Five Star Movement was the largest individual party in the wake of the Italian election results on Monday. Five Star knocked out their competition in Italy and then said, Five Star. Anyway, they are ostensibly on the left. Now, they're populist, so it's not the same exact lines as you would see in America between liberals and conservatives, but they're talking about universal income. That is way to the left of anything in America. And they got the most amount of votes. So a lot of people are painting this like the right wing one in Italy, and you'll see why in a second. But that is, they didn't get the most votes, the left wing got the most votes. So now, let's give you more context now from Quartz. On March 4th, Populist Party, Five Star Movement, won the most votes. Meanwhile, radically xenophobic Northern League overtook center-right party Forza Italia. More than half the parliament is now in the hands of upstart populist groups, with moderates both left and right of center crippled. Exactly as Cenk Uygur predicted. No, that's not in the story. Okay. Now let me give you context on how crippled the establishment is in Italy. The center-left Democratic Party received less than 19% of votes, the worst result in its history. Center-right Forza Italia received around 14% of the votes, the worst in leader Silvio Berlusconi's political history. Now, if you take together all the right-wing groups, they have more votes than Five Star. But Five Star has the most votes overall. None of them got to a point where they could form the government on their own. So now there's going to be some, it's basically a hung parliament. There's going to be some jostling to figure out who can make a coalition. And most people assume that the right wing will band together and make the coalition. But you never know. I think there's some chance that as disparate as some of their opinions are, Five Star and Northern League can actually join together and do a coalition government. And it would be a fascinating populist anti-establishment government if they did so. But let me go back to Five Star's bold progressive proposals. This one from Reuters now, the explanation. Its flagship proposal in the election campaign was a minimum monthly income of up to 780 euros for the poor, helping it draw overwhelming support in the underdeveloped South. Guys, this is not that complicated. If you say to people, we're going to look out for you, you're more likely to get their vote. Wow, shocking. For so long, especially in America, the establishment lost sight of how to get votes in a democracy, partly because in America we ended democracy. Now we have private financing of our elections. So almost all the politicians serve the people who wrote their checks, and that's not the public. It's private interests, it's corporations, it's incredibly rich people. But there are two guys who decided to go populist in the last election in America. Their names were Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders closed a 60-point lead on Hillary Clinton, backed entirely by the establishment, Clinton was, and she lost that lead. She hung on to win the primary, and then everybody thought, of course, Hillary Clinton, she's the experienced one. She's got all the endorsements. I kept saying over and over again, those endorsements are counterproductive. We don't like the establishment anymore. For 40, 50 years, they told us, oh, just take your medicine and give us everything. And don't worry, eventually it'll trickle down to you. Well, it isn't. It's not trickling down in Italy. It's not trickling down in America. And everyone is tired of it. So more context here from Reuters. Anti-establishment parties have been on the rise across Europe since the 2008 financial crisis. Italy's mainstream parties have found it especially hard to contain voter anger, with the economy still 6% smaller than a decade ago, and unemployment stuck at about 11%. And in southern Italy, it is far, far worse. So yes, no to the establishment, because you guys are a little dense. People are looking for change. They're so desperate for change, they do things as weird and monstrous as putting Donald Trump, a clown from a circus, as the president of the United States of America. And note to all of the parties across the world, if you don't have a strong populist left, then the voters will choose a populist right. And populist right-wing policies, well, we've seen that movie before in Italy and other parts of Europe. And that movie does not end well. So give up on the preposterous dream that people will wake up and go, oh, you know what? I think maybe the establishment and the elites have my best interests in mind. I'm going to go vote for them again. They're not going to do it. At least give them a reasonable, sane, populist left alternative so we can go back to representing the people, whether it's in Italy, the UK, European Union, or here in America. All right. I got to take a break. When we come back, more amazing stories, including a mayor who slept with her bodyguard. She got kicked out, but was that the right decision or not? It's a really interesting case. I want to talk about that when we return. All right, back on the Young Turks, Cenk and Anna with you. I have a bunch of really good tweets. Yvonne Markovich Ferris writes in, that's really funny. Anyway, thanks gods the CIA has never killed anyone in a false flag operation in order to justify a war. That's a load off my mind. Okay, look, if you're saying the CIA has killed folks before, of course! If you're saying that it's possible the CIA killed a former Russian spy in the UK to start World War III, we're going to have to agree to disagree again. Okay, that is, let's just put it this way, less likely. Okay. Anyway, Crayfish Caddy says, Donald Trump lives in constant fear of being poisoned. Gee, I wonder why. Now, that's a really interesting point.
That is an interesting point. I hadn't put two and two together until you laid it out for me. So.
Yeah, I think one other listener had made that point before too. Mm-hmm. You know what, Crayfish Caddy, you're getting a shirt.
Oh.
ShopTYT.com, you go there, pick any shirt. Actually, some producer will reach out to you. Anyway, but what a weird thing to live in fear of, like getting poisoned, right?
Yeah.
Unless the guys you have business dealings with for the last couple of decades go around poisoning people all across the world.
True. Look, I agree, but at the same time, I feel like anyone who's like a high-profile individual ends up developing like paranoid thoughts. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it could be. It could be either way. Yeah, it's not definitive.
Right.
I don't think we're going to get him in a court of law on that. Anyway, No Way writes in, I genuinely hope that Cenk is right about Donald Trump being impeached, except for the ungodly amount of on-air gloating that will go on afterwards. What do you mean? That's going to be the best part. Anyway, and finally, Nuno Martin says, it's almost like Wall Street has two parties in their pockets. Indeed. Okay. All right, we have some amazing stories for you guys now.
We do. We're live on air, but we keeps it real. Irma, the monitor has too much glare. Can you just, so I can actually read the graphics?
Oh, yeah.
Let's just get
Anna without her glasses is not going to.
Without my glasses and with glare on the screen, it's a recipe for disaster. So
okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, cool.
All right.
All right, let's start off with a woman who is incredibly fearless and inspires me, and I really want to share her story with you guys. It's actually an update on a story that we did earlier. An independent Russian journalist by the name of Tatiana Flegenhauer was the target of a vicious attack earlier. Unfortunately, someone had broken into the news organization that she works for. It's a radio station known as Echo, and proceeded to stab her. In fact, she got stabbed in the throat. And luckily, she did survive that vicious attack, and she is still able to do her job. And so she did something incredible recently. She decided to go to one of Putin's press conferences with her wound showing and ask him an incredibly challenging question. Now, she's one of the few journalists in Russia who does speak truth to power. She is independent, and she criticizes Putin regularly. And so there have been some speculation that the attack against her, which was done by a man by the name of Boris Gritz, was actually motivated by the Russian government. Now, again, I don't have evidence or proof of that, but there has been a trend of independent journalists attacked by Putin in Russia. Many of them die mysteriously. And so it's understandable that people have come up with these theories. Now, here is the update to her story. So a few weeks after she was released from intensive care at a Moscow hospital, she surprised Vladimir Putin and millions of Russians watching the annual presidential press conference with a brief but powerful speech about the Kremlin's selective application of justice. Now, she spoke to the Daily Beast about what she had said during the press conference, and here were her thoughts or her feelings right before. She said, at the moment, I was so nervous. I think I was close to having a stroke. As all these people around me who'd been applauding for Putin for hours started screaming to silence me. And so she says that most of the journalists in Russia applaud him, they celebrate him, they never ask him the challenging questions. And if anyone ever has the audacity to ask him the tough questions, those people will be attacked viciously. And so she was nervous from the beginning, but that didn't deter her, it didn't stop her from asking the question that she wanted to ask.
Man, you get stabbed in the throat, and then you come back out the next press conference, and you ask a tough question again.
It's amazing.
Okay, yeah. And she persisted. I mean, this is a total hero. I don't know where people get this kind of courage. So, look, I know that the leading theory in Russia on this stabbing by the officials is that it was a madman who did it. I know. And our government in the past has also said, oh yeah, it was a madman who killed Kennedy and et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Oh, no. Yeah, it's not the people in power. Definitely not that. But all those reporters who criticize Putin that get attacked, all wild coincidences, all by a different individual madman. Man, Putin keeps catching those lucky breaks. And so I'm actually amazed at the courage that they have to continue doing things like this. And
right.
So, and most people haven't. And she says she's really saddened to see people that she looked up to before who are real journalists, who are now just saying everything Putin does is great. And you know, we went to Syria and how cool was that and how badass was it?
Right.
And you know, just praising Putin over and over again. In this 4-hour press conference, whatever he said, the rest of the press, not his loyalists, not people in his party, the press, would applaud wildly. And so it's a really important lesson there, guys. Mm-hmm. It's not that she wasn't nervous and that she wasn't scared. She was. And as all those people were trying to shout her down, she persisted anyway. That's what courage is.
So for me, this story demonstrates what a real journalist is, or who a real journalist is. And what I mean by that is, even if you don't buy that she was attacked by the Kremlin, it's still a traumatic incident. It's something that I think would convince any normal human being to want to quit their job. You know, if you've been targeted in that way and you almost lost your life, you know, to some extent, I almost don't begrudge the other journalists in Russia who are now towing the line for Putin, because I would be terrified. I think most people would be terrified for their lives if you see this pattern of independent journalists who speak truth to power getting targeted, getting murdered. Most people would either quit or they would just do what Putin would want them to do. In this case, regardless of who you think is behind that attack, she was brave enough very close after this attack to go to this press conference and ask a tough question about a double standard in the justice system in Russia. And so what she pointed out was, hey, I'm noticing, Putin, that the people that you're supportive of, the people who are supportive of you, will break the law and they get off easy. But then others who will have some sort of minor offense get the book thrown at them pretty aggressively. Now, I'm paraphrasing what her question was. But Putin did not like that question. In fact, let's go to graphic 51. According to the Daily Beast, journalists sitting in the first row noticed that the president's face turned red, and he responded back by saying, I disagree that there are two parallel realities. The law has not been broken. It's just, it's amazing that she had the guts to ask that question. Also, she says, what really makes me sick is to see how people we consider to be professional journalists so recently have stopped being professional and joined the state propaganda. Also, another independent journalist spoke about these attacks and said, in Russia, even a reporter like Tatiana, who does not go to cover the war but gives a real picture of politics on a live show, is under a deadly attack. Too many details of that crime, meaning the stabbing, do not add up. For example, everything that the man had written about Tatiana in his internet blog had been edited professionally on the eve of the attack. So,
And
it's crazy.
Yeah, and other people had pointed out that what she's saying about Putin was unacceptable and was Western propaganda. They accused her of sending a message to her right before she was attacked. It's not that complicated. Look, guys, I have to confess that it drives me crazy when I see naivete and about right-wing dictators. And so I've seen this all across the world, and you see it in Russia, you see it in Turkey. Erdogan goes around intimidating the press. Then there's leaked audio of him yelling at the guys who own the media organizations in Turkey. And then people wonder, like, are they biased or not biased? What do you? We all heard it, and the guy was like crying on the phone, like, "Okay, I'm so sorry. I'll do what you want." You think Putin doesn't do that in Russia? So look,
I mean,
there's a tiny percentage chance that she happened to get attacked by a lone madman, and there's almost no chance that every reporter who's been critical of Putin all got attacked by lone madmen, okay? And so I just say that because the people who are in denial over it are to me taking a little bit of credit away from this unreal brave journalist, mm-hmm, who's standing up in the face of enormous power and enormous intimidation, and with a throat that's slit up and that's got a giant scar on it. She grabs the mic, and the way she described it was, look, the answer is one thing, but I must ask this question about corruption, and I must let Russia hear it, because this is the one time in this live press conference. It goes on national television, and it won't get censored by state television. So she laid out the whole case and how Putin's enemy opposition, like Alexei Navalny, faced one kind of justice, really harsh justice, and his de facto deputy, Igor Sechin, gets to evade justice nonstop, won't even show up to court when he's called to court. And she said, in that moment, whatever happened, I wasn't going to let go of that mic. That's journalism. That's the press. That's courage.
She's amazing, and I just really wanted to, you know, share her story because it's rare to come across other media figures that really inspire me, and she definitely does. Her bravery inspires me, and it convinces me to keep pushing through even during the most tumultuous moments. All right, we got to take a quick break. Let's do that. When we come back, we'll go back to the United States for some dramas involving a local mayor in Tennessee, and then later on, an important point in regard to the Bachelor season finale. I promise you there's an important point. Don't miss it.
No, guys, I'm super livid about that, actually. Not having to do with the stupid TV show, but America's reaction to these reality shows. I mean, God damn it, we got a reality show host as president. So, all right, we'll save that conversation for when we come back.